Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Flores
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, gather around whatever apparatus you listen to podcasts on. Usually it's a phone, usually in your car. And get ready for another episode of This Life with Dr. Drew and Bob and Shelley.
Yes, our special guest.
Special host guest.
Oh, hey, guys.
Hey.
So good to be here.
Put that microphone closer to your mouth and give everyone an update on what you're doing.
I'm still doing treatment. Still working in treatment. Doing Bel Air treatment on the outpatient and then the detox. We have a little six-bed detox, and then we have an LGBTQ program in West Hollywood.
Oh, cool.
And so we're
on Melrose.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, we're obviously trying to move forward in growing. You know,
do you have any HIV and AIDS specialization or tracks or anybody you?
We refer to the big LGBTQ
AIDS project. Yeah.
And everyone who works in the Pride program is all very well informed around how to resource these guys, and they're getting resourced in every area that they need to.
Now, since we were all a team, the transgender thing has become much more common. Are you dealing with that?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Yeah, we're dealing okay with that. You know, my little six-bed detox, I don't have the room and the space, so we're referring to places that have like a singular room for the individual so mm-hmm. that they can feel comfortable. However they're identifying, yeah. We want to put them in a place where they feel comfortable,
yeah.
And also where they feel safe. And yeah. Then everyone, you know, is working towards treating them appropriately around, you know, I'm just doing detox, so I'm just trying to stabilize. You know, I'm not trying to dig into any, you know, real mental health at that point. I'm just trying to stabilize and get them glued together,
again,
so to speak.
Worth a reminder, one of the grave misconceptions that people have is how soon into the process of addiction treatment you can get involved in the mental health stuff. I mean, you can treat the symptomatology for sure.
Yes.
But you can't really dig in until you've been stable for
Their
a while.
Their own Bible says you shouldn't do it for a year, Dr. Drew.
Whose Bible?
The psychiatric Bible.
Yeah, I know. I prefer 6 months, but I'll settle for 3 sometimes.
Yeah.
So.
But
yeah, well, some of these guys come in and they've had multiple experiences with multiple clinicians.
Yeah.
And they already know about some of their trauma stuff. They already know about some of their diagnoses. They already know about some medications. So you're rarely getting somebody who doesn't already have an idea of what they're dealing with.
Yeah. And they sometimes identify with their diagnoses.
Well, that's
They'll tell you that they are that. And I'll say, well, let's figure it out. I don't know what you are.
You have to be sober long enough to know.
Exactly. And so I ask them, you know, hey, let's just do this. Let's just get from point A to point B. Let's just stabilize. And we'll see how that, you know, works out.
Yeah.
But we're just going to really talk about like how you're going to navigate your withdrawal symptoms right now.
All right. I sent you one. I hope he shows up.
I hope he does too.
He's not getting what's going on.
But can we go back in time 20 years to when I started doing this, Shelley started doing it, you were already doing it.
Yeah.
Psychiatry and chemical dependency were two separate universes.
Oh, Bob. Bob, the
they
reason,
were two separate
hold on,
universes.
Hold on. No. You don't know the history. Because the reason I got my job, because there was in the 80s, they were separate universes. And psychiatry got very upset about this because they started saying that the addiction specialists, their addiction team, which were often very big in those days, were usurping their patients. They got very defensive. And at Las Encinas, the guy who I learned from got pushed out. And they put a psychiatrist, Chris Rutland, in that job. Do you know this?
No.
Oh. Well, so Chris Rutland gets he's an excellent psychiatrist. We all work with
him.
We love Chris.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
He calls me one day, and he goes, you know, you're spending all this time down in the unit. I was getting very good at detoxing. I really was not super good on addiction yet. I didn't fully get it. I still thought that thing on the wall that said 12 steps is sort of silly, and I was very, very naive. But I was very good at the biology and the early withdrawal and stuff. And he goes, hey, man, you're down there all the time. How about you be my co-director? You be my assistant director. And it's nothing. I'll take vacations in Christmas time. You just cover me then. It's 2 weeks. You're there anyway. It's no big deal. You got it. I go, oh, thanks, man. Fast forward 6 months. He quits. Ooh. And I moved into the directorship because of that, mm-hmm. and had to really get my act together very, very, very quickly. And it was a few rocky years of building teams and stuff. And
but
then I found you guys.
Traditionally, I worked at MAP. There was no psychiatry at MAP.
Bob,
nobody cared about
the reason I was ideal.
People.
But listen, the reason I was ideal, I'm an internist. I'm not a psychiatrist. So I was of no threat to psychiatry and no threat to anybody. I didn't want their patients. I just wanted them to bring their patients and feel free to join me in the treatment that we
But the two different worlds I'm talking about is I was, you know, I've been working with CryHelp recently. I just love it. It's like like how you feel about SC, that's how I feel about CryHelp.
Amherst, not SC.
It's true.
Amherst, not SC.
That's so great.
So CryHelp was a separate universe. Nobody cared about diagnosing patients bipolar. MAP was a separate universe. The psychiatry did not factor into dealing with drug addicts.
Well, but that was a little bit of a
weakness. But now it's all different. All right. You go to Music Cares, everybody's dual diagnosis. Yeah. You go to CryHelp, everybody's dual diagnosis.
Perfect.
And here's my point. We know how to get people sober.
Yeah.
I don't know what they are. I don't know if they're transgender or this or that or bipolar or whatever.
Yeah.
I know how to help somebody achieve sobriety.
That's right.
That's my job. Now they've complicated our job so much with pharmacology and diagnoses and whatever, and it's fun to get a hold of. But I've just gone back to sober is sober is sober.
Good, good.
Because the courts only care about sober is sober. I'm going back to the courts.
Oh, that's interesting.
The courts don't care if you're bipolar.
No.
They want you to stop taking meth.
Please. And
The overusing of psychostimulants now is unbelievable.
It's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. I don't know who to send people to anymore when they want to get off.
Me.
But they're not drug addicts even.
But a lot of times they need to be in locked units.
No, I'm saying these aren't even drug addicts. These are just
excessive prescribing.
And they're like, why am I on this shit? I'm irritable, agitated,
inflated.
Oh,
no, I thought you were talking about
the meth.
I mean, it's to an astral projection that they can't. They're not safe in a chemical dependency detox unit.
The meth addicts?
Yeah.
Why?
Some of them
are just psychotic for a month.
I know.
For a month.
Yeah.
Not only for a month, dude. They after they stop the drug, it could be up to 3 months, and the focus on their primary relationships is continued, and they fuck those relationships up, and the object of the paranoia doesn't understand what's going on. It's always workers, coworkers, neighbors, family.
Parents.
And they just disrupt those relationships.
As well. And it goes on for much longer. Much longer. There's a lot of residual.
Oh, yeah.
No, I'm talking years.
Oh, they have memory and mood problems. Forever.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I always tell them.
They'll pop right into that.
But I always tell them you will for a long time walk down the street and still look over your shoulder.
Absolutely.
They just keep looking.
They definitely have that for 5 years. They can have it for quite some time. And some people are having, you know, actual diagnoses around some kind of level of psychotic disorder.
And so you have to ask yourself, what the psychiatrist asks him or herself is this bipolar disorder that is made worse by the drug? Is this somebody who has a psychotic disorder caused by the drug? Is this some post-amphetamine-related residual? At that point, doesn't matter.
I'll go you one further. The society is so unsafe and scary.
Oh, yeah.
You add meth.
Yeah.
Beginnings of schizophrenia, the society, you know, it's an overwhelming combination of problems. But you can get people sober. That's what I've gone back to the last 2 months. You can get people sober.
Yeah.
I don't even want to talk about the other things. I say, you got a psychiatrist. Yeah. Talk to them.
Yeah.
Right? You could be sober.
Well, that's why I kind of always dealt with it.
And you'd be surprised when you deal with 20, 22, 24-year-olds. They don't even know that benzos are addictive.
I know.
Like, no, you can't take benzos. That means you're high. No, you can't take Adderall. That means you're high.
I know.
You just lay down what sobriety is. And they're longing for attachment and love and connection and community, and they'll embrace it. But when I try to go down that road with psychiatry and all that, it's just...
No, I know.
It's just a never-ending world. Right. It's like Alice in Wonderland.
Well, I can go some places
You're better at it. You know that
I can go some places with them.
With
psychiatry, I can go as far as they want to go if they want to treat symptoms. But I'm not going to work on diagnoses
if
someone is just sober or hasn't been diagnosed with long-term sobriety.
Correct.
And sometimes I get them, and they have had long-term sobriety, and they have struggled with depression, and they have struggled with maybe anxiety. and they've been able to maybe to have an SSRI, and that's worked for them.
Of course.
But
what trauma survivor doesn't have anxiety?
Exactly.
And what American doesn't?
Yeah, I know these days.
What
you
have
so
it?
Much anxiety.
Oh, I'm a fool.
You've got it.
I have. I have.
Not too much of a narcissist to have it.
Three sociopath. It's, so I think I have PTSD, generalized anxiety, and panic.
Uh-huh.
I have all three, and I have generalized anxiety disorder.
Formally.
And this is what is important for moms, because I know a lot of moms listen to this show because I hear about it. So moms who have these kids that are 22, non-functioning, diagnosed since they were 16 with all these ADHD and this and that and bipolar disorder and all this kind of stuff, they're so confused because their kids are taking fentanyl and meth.
Yeah.
And they're going to die of it.
Yeah.
I guarantee you they're going to die of it. They're not going to die of ADHD. But there's no axes anymore.
Yeah.
Psychiatry has changed the paradigm of how you prioritize.
DSM-5 is different. Yeah,
yeah, completely different. Yeah.
And
you still like thinking in terms of axes. So do I.
I don't.
They don't use it anymore.
I don't now.
DSM-5. No. It's like narrowing down specific, very tightly controlled diagnoses and sort of frequencies and courses.
All
like
frequencies, courses.
Well, when they're
severity.
Using fentanyl and meth every day, how frequently is an occurrence of that?
Right.
Well, I mean, now we're having to diagnose each substance.
Right,
individually.
And you can't say polysubstance addiction anymore. No. All right, hold on a second. We'll take a little break. When we come back, we will talk to Celine Gounder. I want to welcome True Niagen to the show. True Niagen is a dietary supplement designed to boost key cellular resource called NAD. It's also, that's short for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. It's a coenzyme found in every living cell. It's essential to our cells, and it's a key mediator of metabolism. A lot of work being done on NAD these days. I've been watching it very carefully. The science is preliminary, but it's been looking good in a lot of areas. What's exciting about these studies is that the increased NAD levels may potentially help with cellular metabolism, regulating circadian rhythm, and they're even hopeful it may slow the effects of aging. Very interesting research, and seemingly no adverse effects. So while studies are very early, science out there is impressive. The biohacking community has gotten behind the research. Actually, the addiction treatment community has gotten behind it, too. I've been intrigued with the possibilities surrounding NAD and the research behind True Niagen. I suggest you check it out for yourself. Go to their website. In June, I had a chance to speak with the company's chief scientific advisor, Dr. Charles Brenner, on the Dr. Drew podcast. It was deep science, and it piqued my interest. In fact, I got on the product after talking to him. Definitely check out that episode. And to learn more about the research, the science, and the True Niagen supplements, visit TrueNiagen.com. That is TrueNiagen.com. Check it out today. And we are back. We're talking to infectious disease expert Celine Gounder. Celine Gounder, welcome to the program. Here we are.
There she is.
So Bob wants to talk to you.
My pleasure.
Yeah, wants to talk to you about this New Yorker article you wrote, which we all admired. And go ahead, Bobby.
Well, you took a track that Drew takes, which is blame the doctors, right? Should we fill people in at home?
Well, to an extent.
So, A, does anybody believe the doctors, you've mentioned it, were brainwashed by the marketing campaign of Purdue you could take as much opioids as you want?
They were duplicitous and
but
a physician.
But I don't believe the doctors believed it, and that makes them evil.
No, there was a religious fervor around the treatment of pain.
There still is,
and,
by the way.
I know. And you and I lived through this, and Shelley, you were with us too during this, when we were hand over fist taking chronic pain patient off
opiates.
You just
want to talk about that doctor we had escorted off the grounds,
I know.
Came to visit
I know.
His pain management client.
Laid down at his feet. And so we had
that was in your unit too.
We had horrible.
Drew lost his mind, walked out, and said, "Get him off the property." I was like, "I don't think I have the right to make a doctor leave the property."
In any event, we were dealing with this all the time, and patients would come in saying, "I'm having 15, 18 on a scale of 10 pain." We would take them off opiates, put them on an anti-inflammatory, some Toradol, and within 2 weeks, what was the number? First of all, they would not mention their pain unless we prompted it.
They were fine, but there was an emotional attachment to those doctors.
Oh, sure, because they got the drugs from them.
Exactly.
Of course there was.
in a Pavlovian way.
But Celine, let's hear you talk about your article.
Yeah, so I mean, I think I went through some of what you guys went through in the course of my own training. You know, we were taught, if you give OxyContin around the clock, they're not going to have withdrawal. They're not going to get addicted because you're not going to have the highs and the lows. And so it's perfectly safe. And this is something I was taught as a resident, you know, not so long ago. And so, you know, I think that doctors really did think they were doing the right thing by their patients, at least, you know, up to a point. And I think, you know, unfortunately, where we are now is, you know, another phase of the epidemic. So regardless of who you blame, though, for, you know, starting it, and certainly doctors were a participant in that, part of the problem. You know, now we're at a point where we're dealing with heroin and fentanyl, which are not prescribed by doctors.
And listen, you got to understand, I was vilified because they were literally, there was a discipline in medicine. You train your residents, give more opiates. If you don't, pain is the fifth vital sign. It's as important as your pulse. And you, meaning our team, you don't understand the heat I came under for taking people off opiates. I was considered cruel and unnecessary and barbaric and old-fashioned. And we would take people off, and then our peers would literally kill them because they would add in the benzodiazepine, and that would be that.
And Jeff put them Conway. Back on.
Jeff Conway being the poster child.
But I want to show you. I got this from UCLA. I sent a client to UCLA, and I got this back, and it says safe pain medicine prescribing in emergency departments, and it goes through a list of things now that they're giving the clients that they're stating we are not going to prescribe pain meds, we want one provider, we want one pharmacy. And so now, I mean, at least I'm getting patients coming back from UCLA with some idea
it's better
around not prescribing pain meds.
I would argue we're going to go actually overboard.
I would imagine we would go overboard. But I'm happy to see this.
And you should know there's this Cures program in California
that we have to sign up for, too. We're going to actually be online with the Cures program because we have so many clients coming in saying they're on this, they're on this, they're on this. They've been on this for 10 years, this on 5 years. And we can't really get a read exactly who's on what and for how long to know what their withdrawal symptoms and to what to expect in a detox situation.
And Celine Gounder is an infectious disease doctor. She's dealing a lot with HIV and AIDS. What you know, I'm sure you're seeing lots of, as you said, fentanyl and heroin. What do you, these are complex patients. What are you doing with them?
So we're seeing a big spike in fentanyl overdoses in New York City, as we are across the country. And so, you know, the first thing you got to do is just stabilize them. So a lot of that is obviously just getting them a safe place to stay, a safe place to, you know, live after they're discharged. And just that has been a huge barrier. You know, when you revive somebody, you know, what next? Well, they need to be stable enough to go into drug treatment. And a lot of times we don't have the beds. So you then send them, you know, out, and there's no obvious place to go. Unfortunately, a lot of them are homeless or marginally housed. And so it's really difficult with those patients to help. It's very different from, you know, your celebrity patient who has all the resources at their disposal. When somebody is, you know, that much on skid row, it's really difficult.
Yeah, well, the problem is on our side, it's they sprinkle in meth and now they're psychotic and on opiates and they don't want to come in for treatment. They want to stay on the street and we have no ability to mandate they're helping them. And so they spiral down because we have no ability. They may be expanding gravely disabled in California.
I hope they do.
Yeah. So
I really hope they do.
I do
think
too.
That's going to be one of the bigger things is I had a gravely disabled person, you know, yesterday and, you know, I have no recourse.
None.
And I sent them to UCLA and they sent them back to me.
Yeah.
And this person is,
that happens,
you know,
all the time.
Psychotic.
So we may feel better mandating they go somewhere. There's no place for them to go.
Well, they were full.
They're always full. Yeah. They're always full.
Well, no. The week before I sent someone and they kept him for 4 days. So, I mean, they're not always full.
Did that person have good insurance?
They both equally had PPOs. Both clients had relatively the same.
Well, no, but she's talking about, you know, Medicaid.
Yeah, they had
people,
insurance. Period.
It's impossible. I deal with a lot of Medicaid people. There is no places for them to
That's
go.
That's true.
You just said CryHelp's taking Medi-Cal
for detox.
Just detox.
And I'm not talking about psychotic people or people are resistant to treatment. They have to be willing,
stable. Yeah.
and ready to go.
Which is almost nobody. at the beginning.
Well, definitely almost nobody. And in addition to that, sobriety isn't sober anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've noticed this or not, but being sober
and
means
so not to
that
discourage
you're not
him,
doing
but
your drug of choice.
I spoke at the oldest AA meeting in Los Angeles last night. I remember going there in the 80s, and there were 250, 350 people crammed in this room. There was less than 40 there last night. Boy. So why is it not attractive in a time when it's so desperately needed? Well, narcissism.
It's narcissism, and there's been a campaign against it. And there is the psychiatry will give them gratifying meds like Suboxone.
Because you don't have to be sober anymore to be sober.
Yeah.
And that's true. It's true. And I'm fighting cannabis on a daily basis as a harm reduction.
Oh,
everyone's choosing harm reduction at this point, which we didn't really have so much of when we were younger. It was either you were using drugs or you were sober, and it was pretty clear. There was methadone. That was a little, you know, in NA or whatever, you know. But we knew when we were smoking cannabis that we weren't sober. We knew when we were drinking booze we weren't sober. And, like, sober meant something, and now it doesn't really mean as much. And
you're going to make Drew cry. Come on.
I'm faced with every single day.
So let's get Dr. Gounder's input.
It's insanity.
Let's get Dr. Gounder a chance to make comment.
Well, I mean, what's wrong with that on some level? If you're keeping people alive, I mean, isn't that ultimately the goal here? You know, why does it matter if somebody needs to take methadone or buprenorphine or really anything to stay alive? You know, what's our goal as physicians, at least, is to keep people alive. And I think part of the reason a lot of people are not ready to go into treatment is because addiction is fundamentally, at least in my opinion, it's a disease of bad options. You know, there's a reason people are turning to drugs in the first place, becoming dependent. They're trying to medicate something that is very much wrong. And some of that has to do with, you know, some of the things that have happened to them in life and not seeing a way out of that situation. So I think part of our job is to create trust, to help people stay alive, feel better, and some of the things we might be focusing on might be getting them a place to stay, dealing with other things other than the addiction so that they understand that we're there to help them to be ready to really quit.
See, right. That's our problem is we know what it takes to really quit, and we are not interested in just alive. We are interested in returning to a fully thriving existence.
Well, I don't think
we want people to stay alive, but we want them to continue on the process of thriving.
I'm going to say something really controversial. I've dealt with probably 30,000 addicts in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
A lot of them don't want to be alive.
Yeah.
There is no hope out there in this country. There is too much divisiveness, hopelessness, helplessness, learned helplessness.
Well, so what?
Right?
You're not going to address that?
We need to tell these young people, what are you talking about? There's all kinds of opportunity in life. There's amazing things going on.
Can they respond to that when they're strung out on replacement
But
therapies?
Here's the thing, and we've talked about this. They attach to me. I'm like the weird uncle or the therapeutic bond, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. I get them inspired, and sadly or positively, most of them end up working in treatment.
Mm.
And I have like 200-300 people that I know that were of that ilk. They didn't care whether they were alive. It didn't matter. This is everything sucks type mentality that was different than our generation's everything sucks. This is a hopelessness I've never seen before in young people. Mm. And they've been brainwashed to believe that nothing is possible. And you have to re-educate them, re-parent them into this hopeful state.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of fucking work.
I know.
It takes hour by hour for years.
Can you do it when they're still on replacement?
Sometimes, but those tend to just drift away. The harm reduction, I'm trying not to be arrogant about it. I have no faith that harm reduction is going to help in any way long term.
Right.
5 years from now, they're just going to be on fentanyl, and we'll deal with them then.
Right.
This is a kicking a can down the road. It's not a long term solution.
Correct, because we know addicts, we know what they do, we know how this works.
And what's frightening is the fentanyl. So the New Yorker also, New Yorker is one of my favorite, you know, outlets for news. The New Yorker also did an article about fentanyl, and I read it about a month ago. I've talked about it every day since then. $3,800 for a kilogram of pure fentanyl from China, when diluted correctly and put into pill form on the streets of the United States, is worth $30 million. Mm. Think about that. Think about the profit. $4,000 investment, $30 million profit.
Crazy. Mm.
Heroin is $50,000 investment, $200,000 profit.
Right.
Heroin will fade away into the distance only to be replaced by fentanyl, or they're what they're doing now, which I believe is why people are dying so much. The things that people are buying that they think is heroin is fentanyl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
To looks and resembles heroin, but it's not.
Sure.
It's fentanyl.
Well, I'm seeing a
and
lot
your
of it
two
come
doctors
up.
Here, why don't you talk about the why did they create a drug so powerful?
Well, fentanyl was created really for severe, severe pain. I mean, the situation in which I use it for patients is patients who have cancer, who have end of life, mm-hmm. you know, very severe metastatic cancer.
Why is it
we
produced...
also use it as anesthesia if you're undergoing?
Yeah, why is it produced in such potency? 1 kilogram has enough potency to dilute just, down to $30 million worth of
you're
street
just,
value.
You're comparing apples and oranges. It's a highly potent chemical. Therefore, low quantities will be potent. That's it.
When a pharmaceutical company is developing a drug like that, is there a brain trust that goes, oh, my God, is this really good for mankind?
No, they go, oh, my God, we're going to help these people with cancer who suffer so much. And we're going to find a way to deliver it sublingually and through their skin so they don't even have to be awake and we can limit their suffering. Mm-hmm. And so, believe me, I've used crap loads of it in cancer.
So the doctor, I want to ask the doctor, do you think moving forward after this tsunami of death that Purdue has cast upon our land that pharmaceutical companies will consider the diverted potential for drugs they are developing?
They do consider that. That's why they add naltrexone in and all this stuff, but they don't really understand addiction. And so they don't fully appreciate
it's
how
it's
going
to work. It's the leading cause of death in America.
They don't understand it.
Doctors don't understand that it's the leading cause of death in America.
I'm going to bet, though Dr. Gounder deals with drug addicts all the time, she's never worked in an abstinence recovery-based program, and she's never seen that happen. Mm-hmm. Am I right, Dr. Gounder?
I've never seen that work.
See? This is somebody who works with addiction every day, and she's never seen what we work in all the time and did for 30 years. So they're never exposed to it. They just mm-hmm. never see it.
Right.
They don't know what you do, Shelley. They don't know what you do, Bob. They know how to save lives, which is great,
right?
But they don't fully see the people on the other side that we deal with all the time.
In New York City, Mount Sinai has been doing it for 70 years.
The treatment's out there, but it's not the standard of care. It's not the standard of care.
Bellevue's been doing it. Bellevue has an alcohol ward that Jody Wexler worked at
for
10 years.
For alcohol. Dr. Gounder works in AIDS and drug addiction at Bellevue. Mm-hmm.
There's not an addiction unit within the Bellevue system?
That will be all replacement therapy.
Okay. Well, see how that works. But Bellevue had to have had that. I know the LCSW.
I can tell you where people survive.
The what?
She's keeping them alive.
So when they moved to that unit that's known as the alcohol ward, where a friend of mine worked as the LCSW for 10 years, that's an abstinence-based chemical
alcohol treatment ward.
Just alcohol. Not opioids.
Not opiates. It's considered a different, it has a totally different landscape.
So they just go to voucher housing and Suboxone and get a job?
Oh. Yeah. Well, that's the challenge, right? Who's going to hire somebody who has a jail or prison record for drug use? I mean,
well,
it's
I've
really
tried
hard to,
talk,
to turn
I've,
your life around.
I've tried to
no
talk
one is
to
Subway.
Give you a job. Subway is a company that's considering it.
Oh, well, a lot of my clients end up in the working in recovery.
Yeah, that's
because
the only place.
We don't do a lot of background checks, and most of us who sort of were grandfathered in, we had a past, and that
what?
You know people become you know different around you know sobriety or recovery. But I do understand that there is a difference in the way that people are becoming addicted,
right, so,
and there is a
so,
way that people are becoming sober.
There
and
is
it
a
is different.
There is a funny story though that you protected me. So when you said come work at Los Encinos, I was like, oh, this is a hospital. And then they did the whole HR thing with that really nice lady that worked for Lillian, and I did a nice interview and whatever. And then I filled out all the stuff. And when I was filling out the convicted felony, I've never been convicted of
right.
a felony.
So I said,
you know, I have been arrested a few times.
Yeah.
Is that going to, I just want to tell you up front because,
yeah.
you know, I'm 5 years sober. And she said, oh, no, Dr. Drew has had other people here. We
yes.
understand that.
Right.
Right. So then 2 days later, they call me back and they go, I sit in this lady's office and she has a paper report. She goes, Robert, you've been arrested 19 times.
That was more than
I was
two.
Like, but I've never been convicted of a felony.
But you're like, but I'm Bob.
But so here's the deal. Here's what I want to say is that there's about to be a Cochrane meta-analysis.
Okay.
It's going to be published through Harvard. A guy named John Kelly and a guy named Keith Humphreys are going to put out a study that shows that mutual aid societies are as effective as any other treatment available today. Now,
that's still not saying much.
Hold on.
Because the success
you're right.
is really low.
Except there's an ancillary study that I believe Keith Humphreys has, if I remember right, where he talks about what's called the warm handoff. He did a study where he went into emergency rooms around the country, not around the country, in the VA system, and said, hey, we're going to give you two options. You either give these patients some education and a pamphlet about 12-step, or bring in somebody from a 12-step group, shake their hand, and tell them, I'll meet you tonight at a meeting. Uh-huh. So they did this study. And amongst the people that had the pamphlet and the education about 12-step, what do you think the attendance rate was?
None.
Zero. The attendance rate amongst those who got the warm handoff,
yes.
what do you think that
30%.
100%.
100%.
100%
wow.
attendance
okay.
at 12-step.
That day?
Whatever they arranged with the handoff, okay. the gal that came in.
The guy had to go get them. So, that's not true because you have to go get that addict right. that next yes. day.
All right, whatever. And what I wanted you to talk to Dr. Gounder about, though, is what would have happened to you guys had you been put on replacement therapy and not put through more rigorous abstinence-based treatment?
Well, really, it was the people of that era. I would not have gotten sober, but the people of that era wouldn't have tolerated that. And
Let's say you're getting sober today.
I probably would have died because, for me, replacement therapy is not what I'm looking for, because the emptiness is catastrophic when you're an opiate addict and you're put on replacement therapy. I get that we're staying alive, like heartbeat, vitals. Yes, we're staying alive. But the emptiness, that experience of the emptiness that I can't fulfill unless I go to Bob's house and we sit around and play guitar and commune, like I can't get that from a replacement substance.
All the things that sobriety are. And you're forgetting, I was on buprenorphine in 1986.
Oh, that's right. You started.
So was she.
She was on methadone.
Yeah, I was on buprenorphine.
You were a buprenorphine addict for a while.
Yeah, for years and years. Pete, me,
everybody
we knew was. Because Dr. Mark, who believed in it, he was an evangelical harm reduction guy long before it became legal. Remember that guy?
Yeah, I do remember him.
And he lost his license.
Yeah,
he lost his
But he was a trailblazer, and he sat down. This is the great thing about him. He sat down for like 45 minutes with you and learned about you and knew you and talked with you and explained to you. And I remember him saying this: I don't think you're going to get sober anytime soon, but that's the goal. But in the meantime, this can help you.
And did it help you, or did you start?
Yeah, it helped. It made you think about what you're doing. I remember thinking, it's so fucking mechanical.
Uh-huh.
I'm thinking I'm Keith Richards, and he's just saying you're just a drug addict, and here's some drugs so you don't die.
Right.
So let's expand this more. I'm going to ask Dr. Gounder, what about things like safe injection sites?
I'm for that.
And what about giving heroin addicts heroin?
Well, let's talk about her real area of expertise, HIV and AIDS. Yeah. It was ACT UP who went and did the handoffs. They are the best example of going to bedsides and inspiring people who felt like they had – I was there. My bass player had it in 1984. So they made you feel a part of what Shelley's talking about, that me and her and all our friends that got sober was a part of something. It was amazing here in Los Angeles what happened in the HIV and AIDS community because
people,
of that, the ACT UP men going to people's bedsides and saying, I have it too, and I'm not dying. Please come with us.
Listen, I dealt with HIV and AIDS a lot in the 80s. I was dealing with it. That was the main preoccupation of my time. And,
but that community
it was
that
the
built
saddest,
up.
Saddest. People forget how horrible
it was. Horrible.
Horrible. Yeah. But let's talk about safe injection sites. Let's give Dr. Gounder a chance here.
Well, a couple of things I would just say about what we've been talking about is that, yes, you guys have survived this, but where are all the people who've died over the last 20 years because they only had access to abstinence treatment? They're not here to say, you know what, that that didn't work for me. You know, I think the reason ACT UP has been so effective is also they were reaching out, they were from the community, advocating for their community, you know, helping people just like them. And I do think that's one of the reasons people who are in recovery are also very effective working in the field. One, it's a way of turning their experiences into something positive. It gives them meaning from, you know, from that painful experience. And they just know what it's like, and can translate that into, you know, just plain talk that people just like them get. You know, I think the beauty of safe injection sites is it's actually really good for both the public as well as people who have problems with addiction. You know, they're really geared for people who are homeless, who have no place to stay, who would otherwise be using in parks and public bathrooms, you know, at the McDonald's. And so for the general public, it means that they're going to be in a place that's safe. You're not going to have these discarded needles in the park. But for the people who are using drugs, it means that they have access to clean needles, other works that are, you know, that they might need for their, for injection. And it means they have people there in the facility if they overdose to help them. And even more importantly, who can get them plugged in for other resources. Why not? So that could be, you know, getting tested for HIV. That could be mental health.
Why not
treatment.
Let them have heroin? Why do we judge?
Well, I think that's coming. I think that's coming.
Well, but
eventually.
Let's ask, why not?
I think injection sites are letting them bring their
own heroin. But why not, if we're going to give them replacement therapy, why not heroin be one of those potential replacements?
Well,
while we enroll them and try to get them motivated.
England does it. Yeah. But let me say that a lot of this movement of safe injection sites is for where the opioid crisis is worst. Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Tennessee, mm-hmm. Kentucky. There's always been that in Los Angeles.
Safe injection sites.
Always. There's always been a needle exchange.
Always,
there's always been people, usually from the sober community, reaching out to that community, making sure to educate them about spreading of infectious disease. I was told it in the 1980s. There's always been in the real metropolitan areas, but an education and outreach program to the addicted community. Safe injection sites like in Vancouver and in Victoria and Canada, I've been to both of them, and that doctor up in Canada, that sounds like Deepak Chopra.
Gabor Maté.
Yes, yes. So he is it's a different mentality, that love and that outreach that's going on through those safe injection sites. I think what we're talking about here is just – to stop the spread of the needles damaging the local community in Huntington, West Virginia, or Lakeside, Ohio, because they've never seen anything like it before.
Right.
Let me give Dr. Gounder a chance. Her website, again, is Celine Gounder, G-O-U-N-D-E-R, CelineGounder.com. The podcast is In Sickness and In Health. And I'll give Dr. Gounder a chance to talk about what kinds of stuff are you discussing on that. On the podcast, and then I want to talk a little bit about your concern. I'm concerned about the breakdown in sanitation and the homelessness in California. It's getting outrageous.
Yeah, what is the disease, Chris? You got what is it?
Norovirus.
When you wipe poop.
Norovirus.
You wipe poop on your mouth, Shelly. You know about this?
I've had it twice.
Oh my God! Yeah. I can't deal with this.
Bob, it's airborne now.
Yeah, it's airborne.
It's volatilized. Mm-hmm. There's so much of it in the homeless encampments that it's all over the place. But Dutch Gounder.
Yeah, so I've actually had Gabor Maté on the show. I've had Mark Tyndall, who's one of the doctors who spearheaded the Vancouver Safe Injection Site program. And I've spoken to folks in Switzerland who, like the Vancouver folks, have looked at heroin-assisted treatment. And yes, it is more cumbersome legally, logistically to do heroin-assisted treatment. But you know what? It actually worked.
I'm sure.
What they found in Geneva and then later in Vancouver was that they were able to stabilize people at a certain dose. And that slowly over time, we're able to taper them down, maybe not get them totally off, but at least, you know, get them stabilized and in a position where they could start to get their lives back together. And in Vancouver, what they're actually doing now is realizing that heroin's like just really difficult to use as a treatment. They're switching to Dilaudid, which is hydromorphone.
Oh,
and they're actually setting up a pilot program where it's almost like an ATM machine where you can go and access your hydromorphone. You have a certain number of doses available. You it's biometric, so only you can access it, and you can do it on your own time, on your own schedule. And it's being done. This is another way of putting some control in the hands of the drug user, but also doing it in a limited way and again, to get them stabilized. And the fact is the data from Vancouver and Geneva is really good. It shows that they've reduced transmission of HIV and hepatitis. They have fewer overdoses. In Vancouver, they've had a decrease in crime. So what used to be happening is people would break in the cars so that they would shoot up in a car or use a car, you know, that they had broken into as a place to turn tricks. And that's no longer, you know, that dramatically dropped with the start of these programs. So I guess it depends on what your goals are. But to me, that all sounds like pretty good outcomes.
Yeah, it's awesome. I just don't know that that guy is so loving, that doctor.
Gabor.
I always forget. Yeah. So, and everybody that works with him is so, it's so open-minded and loving and kind and thoughtful And I just don't believe that exists in Huntington, West Virginia.
There's a lot of moralizing about drug addiction, which is
so
bizarre.
You can have the safe injection sites, but is there going to be the love that I think makes those programs in Canada so effective?
Well, let's. I think we in this country call it community. And Shelley talks about that all the time.
Well, I visited the safe injection site when it first opened in Vancouver years and years and years ago. And
not to use it.
No. I was actually, you know, pretty newly sober actually at the time when I went to visit. And because my daughter's family's, you know, up there. Her dad lived in Vancouver for many years, and his family's up there. And so we visited, and the problem was that they were openly using on the sidewalks. There was needles on the sidewalks. They were utilizing vehicles for, you know, that element. And Vancouver, you know, decided to do something about that, whereas, you know, we were sort of behind the curve on doing stuff about that. And now we have such a level of homeless, you know, with all of the contagion. And the diseases.
So I'm going to go back one more time to Dr. Gounder about this. So this is a different topic now, but before we close that, I want to address it because here in Los Angeles, we have homeless encampments everywhere, and on each side of each encampment are gigantic mounds of feces and trash and breaking down food that people hand the homeless people, covered with rats. The rodent control people in Los Angeles and San Francisco now cannot keep enough rat traps in supply to manage what's happened in the community now. So we have gigantic mounds of feces with volatilized norovirus coming out. You've had norovirus twice. My son's had it once. And we now have rickettsial disease breaking out through the rodent-borne fleas.
What is that?
Like Rocky Mountain spotted fever. It's murine typhus locally here. I just want to know if Dr. Gounder, if you share our concerns about where this is going this summer and where it might end up. Because it's a breakdown not just of it's a breakdown of civilization here. It's forget the city government. Civilization, the foundation of it, is unraveling in this town. And I'm wondering if Dr. Gounder has any concerns.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I mean, we're seeing homelessness increasing across the country, but especially in cities along the West Coast. And a lot of this, if you think about it, is being driven by gentrification. It's the tech cities in general. You know, Seattle is actually one of the worst affected. But all up and down the coast, San Diego has had a huge outbreak of hepatitis A among the homeless that they finally now are just getting under control. And you had communities saying, well, these people are homeless. We don't want to enable them, you know, to use the language of addiction. We don't want to enable them by providing them with restrooms that they can use and that sort of thing, you know, hygienic facilities. And so as a result, you have the problems that you're now talking about where you have, you know, people who are literally
I've got to interrupt you. It's more complicated than that because I've been working in this area now. And these are chronically mentally ill homeless people that we predominantly have on the streets now. We set up showers, 12 showers, to get one homeless person into a shower took on average 15 separate contacts just to get them into and to stay in a homeless shelter is nearly impossible given the laws of the land presently. They have to be motivated and looking for it, which is
like, have you asked them why?
Ask them what?
What you'll find is if you ask them why, here are some of the reasons they'll tell you. They'll tell you, I can't go into a homeless shelter with my partner because it'll be a single sex homeless shelter. Or else they'll say, I can't take my pet with me into a homeless shelter. Or I'm afraid of having my belongings stolen from me if I'm in a homeless shelter.
Right. That's
why.
All paranoid BS. I'm sorry, because we handle each one of those problems. And as we solve each one, they find another one. And so this is chronic mental illness. We have lots of facilities where to house them. getting
no, we
them.
Don't.
We do now. We do now. And now
where?
And some of them it's towards the desert, but the point is they can't keep them in. They come in and they just go back out, and they have no ability to keep them in the shelters. This is the problem. Orange County cleaned out the Santa Ana Riverbed. They gave them all housing. Only about 30%. I know they're motels and things like that, but they're in nice housing.
Well, that's how Chrissy got the norovirus, was at Knott's Berry Farm. They're all sleeping in the parking lots of Knott's Berry Farm.
That's the ones that refused to stay in the shelters that were being provided to them. And they had, not only did they have shelters, they had social workers and people going in, but these people had no ability to keep. I've been working with this for the last 6 months.
So you want a law enacted that you can conserve people based on their gravely disabled
yeah. and more conservatorship then you could get them better. Then they'd want to, they magically would want to stay as you deal with the psychotic illness and the drug addiction and all the stuff that's
there. Yeah, I mean, I deal with people who have insurance, but that's all.
Yeah.
And I have people who want to be with their partner. I have people who want to take their pets. I have all of these things that the doctor is speaking about, I deal with on a daily basis. I just had somebody yesterday who said they want to be with somebody they want a sober living where they can be with their partner. But they met that partner in addiction 2 months ago. And so I'm struggling with the idea of, yes, but is that appropriate
for
them?
No, from a therapeutic standpoint, that should not happen.
And so that's the difficulty with having someone want to be with their partners when their dynamic is not healthy and both clients are mentally unstable.
Right.
And so then I'm trying to find them to stay together. Yeah. But the one is clearly gravely disabled and needs a conservatorship, is 21 years old, and I don't have a lot of recourse to help that person, and I want to help that person.
Yep. And if you put them in a place together, that will fail.
I don't think that's going to work in my experience.
Dude.
So I'm standing up against this, but I'm just saying every day these are the questions I'm being asked.
To get out of the rut, I was thinking about last night because I spoke at this AA meeting. So AA has a terminology where you have to – it's for people who want it, not for people who need it.
Right.
Right? And I started thinking about that. I needed it but didn't want it. Then I wanted it and needed it. That's the perfect thing, right? Mm-hmm. Then I didn't need it anymore. I wanted it. Mm-hmm. And now it's this constant back and forth of it's not a lot of need for being involved in it. I want to be involved, to be around new people, to help spread this message of hope, right?
Yeah.
I think that's the same approach you're seeing with the homeless. They need it, but they don't want it, right? You're trying to hit that perfect duality.
You're right.
They want it and they need it.
You're right. There are people that are specialized in creating that motivation. Some of them are former homeless. Some of them are social workers with high degree of skill. But it takes a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of manpower. And they have very few tricks up their sleeve to be able to really hang on to these patients. It is extremely difficult. It's getting better. There are teams now being mobilized. But it's clear what's needed is massive mental health services.
I feel like the Red Cross also coming in a way to try to stabilize and to clear away the things that are producing the levels of contagious illnesses. Because I think the Red Cross and, have a good idea of how to do that. We've been doing it in other nations for quite some time. Mm-hmm. I think we can utilize those skills to come in and help the homeless in Los Angeles.
Well, the point is it takes a little army. You're right.
That's what I feel like it does.
And that's what's happening.
Why not the National Guard? I know I sound like
white guy.
No, I'm saying so I think when they get out of Los Angeles, which is a great point, the Upper Desert, Victorville, Antelope Valley, get out there.
That's where they're trying
just
to put
even
some
for
housing.
A month.
I know.
And have it be, get your life together.
There's a giant movement that direction too. That's happening because, by the way, part of the reason is the county representatives that are being very proactive represent those areas, and so they're setting up really cool programs. We got to wrap it up. I want to give Dr. Gounder a chance to tell us more about the Ill Health Tour and also what they can find at CelineGounder.com.
So I work part time at Bellevue Hospital, but I'm also spending a lot of time on Indian reservations across the country. I'm actually headed to New Mexico next month to work on a Navajo reservation up in the northwest corner of the state. And, you know, we're talking about sanitation and homelessness and so on. I mean, this is a part of the state where they still don't have running water. There's a water lady who will deliver your water cooler full of water for the week in some of these communities. And so, you know, you can imagine some of the challenges that they're dealing with there. So it's a really awesome community to work with. There's some really interesting problems, people who really need help. That's what I'll be doing for the next month.
Awesome. Fantastic. And thank you for joining. It's Celine Gounder, C-E-L-I-N-E Gounder, G-O-U-N-D-E-R, CelineGounder.com. In Sickness and in Health podcast at the usual sites, we'll put a link up too. Thank you, Dr. Gounder, and we will see you all next time.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right, that's about it for this episode of This Life. Check us out at KBC, being Lawrence Savon, 790 Midday Live Talk Radio, Monday to Friday. You can also tune in every day live via the magic of the internet at kbc.com. If you miss it, we've made it simple for you to find all the shows at drdrew.com, the Adam and Dr. Drew podcast, the Sing One I Do By Myself, Dr. Drew podcast, This Life, of course, with Bob Swole Patrol, Mike Cantho, at his new health and fitness podcast. You can find us on Twitter at This Life Podcast, at Dr. Drew, Dairy W, at Rehab Bob Forrest, and of course, our lovely producer at First Lady of Love. I think I know who that is. If you love this show, please subscribe and tell a friend. We appreciate it when you do. We'd love to hear your feedback as well. Send us a message. Join the email list at drdrew.com, drdrew.com/contact. You'll also get a weekly email from us on that. While you're at it, at drdrew.com, please support our sponsors by clicking through the banners. We only advertise products that I can get behind. So thank you for supporting them, those that support us. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.